listening to The Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who at one point set on doing philosophy for a living.
And then thought better of it.
Our question for episode 50 is something like, what is the relationship between science and values? And we read Robert M. Persig's 1974 philosophical memoir, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer, exuding quality from Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Seth Paskin in Austin, Texas.
This is Dylan Casey in Middleton, Wisconsin.
Dave Buchanan just dripping with quality in Denver, Colorado.
All right, someone's brave. Brave enough for a simile.
I was just copying you.
I tried to pull one out of my ass and I couldn't do it.
It's not even a simile. What literary form is that? Those funny announcements. What is the type of poetic speech?
I don't know.
Trucking it from Madison, Wisconsin. Farting it through from Madison, Wisconsin. I mean, it's not exactly a metaphor.
No, it's definitely not a metaphor.
It's a piece of wiseassery. I think that's the technical term.
Yes.
Hey, Mark, have you given up on giving the rules?
No, I have not. Let's have our special guest, Dave, introduce himself by telling us what he thinks the ground rules are. Do you remember them, Dave?
Not verbatim, but I could paraphrase. There is no name dropping. Just make your point.
That's right.
Give us the idea. Don't say, for example, oh, I can't believe that because I'm too much of a Kantian. You're going to say, you know, what exactly that means.
We're starting in early on Wes.
And let's see, the other rule is be accurate and precise, except when it's more fun not to.
That's right.
And don't presume that the audience knows anything about this stuff. Be the third rule.
I would say that's 3 out of 3, man.
Woo!
Sweet. I would attach to that rule about name dropping, keep the jargon to a minimum. Use standard American English wherever possible.
Except when you're reading Heidegger and Kant, right?
Right.
Well, you're translating it then to American English. You're not just parroting them, if possible.
You don't say zeitgeist?
You could define it and then say it, yes.
That's part of the common vernacular.
It's part of the zeitgeist?
We should start a thread on which one of the rules people think we violate the most.
Let's start a thread. Sure.
You know, the one I'm having trouble with recently, which is not exactly captured by any of them, but is sort of like the name-dropping one, is understanding the authors that we're reading almost exclusively in terms of the other authors that we're reading. So the diehard fans will get the references. And this is something that we were not tainted with when we started this, because we hadn't done philosophy in a while, and so we could sort of take each text as it came. But especially with this one, I've like, oh, okay, Persig's analysis of quality entering sort of at the outset of experience before analysis, that's just like Schleiermacher. That's just like Merleau-Ponty's primacy of perception. The ubiquity of qualities is just like Foucault's notion of power. It takes a while to get past talking about that to actually get to the specifics for me.
Well, clearly, the Partially Examined Life's mission is to tie all of the major thoughts in the history of philosophy together as being the same thing. So we have the form of the good, being, spirit in history, power in Foucault, quality, Persig. It's all the same thing, right? Different articulations of the same thing.
It seems to me like just in a real vague, broad sense, you can make these comparisons. But then when you really focus in on the idea, you start to see the shades of differences and stuff. And that's where the real interesting stuff is going to happen. But yeah, vaguely, I mean, the suggestions made by the posters on the website seemed reasonable to me. Somebody wanted Seth to compare Heidegger and Persig, too. I thought, maybe there's some, they are saying some very similar things about that always, already in the world kind of thing. Things are ready to hand so that you don't have to think about it. You just walk into a room and you know where the light switch is. And we do most things on autopilot that way. Sort of that primary experiential world. I think they're both talking about that. Maybe they had slightly different things to say about it, but I think it's a worthy investigation. Schleiermacher, I don't know at all.
I was the only one on that podcast who's here tonight. So Wes did not read the book, so he's not on. This was actually a substitute episode. Next time, we're going to have a celebrity guest, Owen Flanagan, and he was supposed to be on this time, but rescheduled. So we're very grateful to Dave for jumping in the breach to give us something a mere few days after the other scheduled one to talk about. This is a book that then the rest of us, those of us that are here, had not necessarily prepared specifically for this podcast, but had some background experience in, had just read in our vast amounts of leisure time. Or in my case, and then I inflicted this on Seth, I listened to this as an audiobook, which was an interesting, different way of taking it in. You can't do that with most philosophy. You can't do that with Kant. I mean, you'd have to stop every sentence and like, what is that about?
Is there an audiobook version of Kant?
Thankfully, no. It almost sounds like someone should make a close reading file and post it on parsleyexaminedlife.com for sale. But imagine. I have not done that yet.
That's an awesome idea.
Hey, Dave, who are you and why are you here?
I just graduated from a master's program in the humanities, and I went in there knowing that I would do my work on Persig. Ended up comparing Persig and William James in my thesis.
And Dave was one of the, has been a periodic poster on partiallyexaminedlife.com among the discussion sections, and I had always been excited and impressed by the things you put up. And I think when I put out a query for potential guests some time ago that you informed me, what, you actually met the guy, right?
I did. I like to say I'm the luckiest amateur philosopher in the world. I was invited over to Liverpool. It was kind of a graduation party for the guy who got the world's first PhD in Robert Persig's philosophy. I owe a lot to this guy, Anthony McWatt. Persig sort of invited himself to this thing, and then it evolved into an amateur philosophy conference. And, you know, I got another call, would you like to write a paper? And so a bunch of us did that. It was kind of had a very amateur feel to it. But anyway, I just happened to get lucky, and I connected with him and chatted with him and had beers with him. And we've been in contact ever since. He helped me through, and mostly by keeping me from wild goose chases and whatnot. He's been very kind, very supportive, and I'm just thrilled to know the guy.
That's cool.
He's kind of a hermit, you know?
But he's actually pleasant to talk to?
Yeah, he's, you know, in the book, he makes himself out to be a madman, but that's not really true. That's kind of just a dramatization, really.
Well, the only reason I ask is because the famous philosophers I've met, it's been a sort of hit and miss about whether they're tolerable human beings or not.
Maybe it was just the mellifluous tones of the guy who read the audiobook that I listened to that I am projecting onto the actual Robert Persig. But I would expect him to be pretty cool. But I do have to do a little digression here and say, who are the famous philosophers that Dylan has run into that he's hit or missed on?
Well, when I was an undergrad, I studied a lot of Richard Rorty, and I got the chance to meet him at a conference that was at Michigan State when I was there, and tried to spend some time because I was really interested in what he had to say. I'd spent a lot of time reading his books and was interested in his ideas about science and nature. You know, I was ending my undergrad work, and I was planning at that time already going on into physics, but spending a lot of time on philosophy. And you would read him, he spends a lot of time talking about conversation and stuff like that. He was absolutely non-conversational at all. He was, one of my colleagues at St. John's had called him lugubrious. And he was in no way opened any kind of conversation with this young undergraduate. I had to work as hard as I have ever had to work with the most naive and recalcitrant undergrad myself as a professor just to try to get him to say anything. He always had one-word answers. It was a big contrast to my expectations.
Persig sounds like in his book, and not even just in the one that we read, but I scanned through the first 150 pages or so of his follow-up work, Lila. And in that one, too, it's like the other characters don't like him, and he characterizes himself and through their eyes as, you know, somebody that just is not a good conversationalist and is cold and distant and et cetera.
The character in the Zen book is a huge prick.
Do you really think he's that much of a prick in the book?
I think there are times that he comes across that way.
Yeah.
Dragging, what is it, 11-year-old?
Something like that.
11-year-old son, dragging him across country on the back of a motorcycle and being totally unsympathetic to his whining.
It is not how I would design a father and son a vacation myself. I used to do that with my dad, and we'd like go to the Indiana Dunes campground, just the two of us for a night or two, and go to the beach, and he'd let me buy ho-hos and read Mad magazines and stuff like that. Not, why don't you sit in the back seat, and I'm just going to think. I mean, it does talk about him like reading books of philosophy or something aloud to him, or what was it?
Walden.
But
it fails. He admits it fails, right? It doesn't work.
But it sounds like it's a regular thing that they do, like that there's this whole intellectual connection that is not expounded upon.
But there are also numerous scenes where the kid is off outside the campfire and he's like, I want to do this. And father's like, the main character is like, no, just go to sleep. We're not doing that. There's a lot of times where he won't even talk about things. He won't even respond to him. Maybe we should get into the relationship between the father and the son. Or maybe that's the secret to the book. I don't know.
One of the posters on the website mentioned the unreliable narrator. And I think this explains a lot about your complaints. I mean, what the deal is that Phaedrus is the real guy. And the narrator is sort of this bullshitter, people pleaser. He just wants to stay out of the psych hospital. He's just going to do everything he can to appear normal because he wants to avoid the psych hospital, the electroshock therapy. This is a nightmare, and he doesn't want to have anything to do with that ever again. And so he develops this fake personality. His son just knows sort of intuitively that this is fake and wrong, and I'm not happy. My real dad disappeared a few years ago, and I want him back. And so that's the tension in their relationship.
Yes, and we should say for people that haven't read this, and we're going to spoil what little plot there is. It's not really that important, frankly.
Right. They all die in the end.
Exactly. They die in a motorcycle accident with Camus. So the thing is a memoir while the guy is driving his son cross country, but the whole backstory, some of which he reveals, he's sort of giving his intellectual history. And so part of this intellectual history is he studied some philosophy and he taught at a university rhetoric and et cetera. But then he basically had a mental breakdown. And so all this is happening after he went through this electroshock treatment, which he says erased his personality, essentially made him into a different person. So he refers to his earlier self as Phaedrus. It's halfway through the book before it's even clear that he's talking about himself. And then he doesn't really admit that it is the same personality or doesn't feel like that until pretty much the end.
I would call the book an intellectual biography, and then his intellectual life is divided into two parts, before and after the electroshock therapy. And this really happened. He was tested like a 170 IQ. He went to college when he was 14. He was studying chemistry and physics and things like that. And he got real stuck on the question of where is the foundation of science? What I expected, you know, he's 14 years old, what I expected before I came here to college was to find like the truth, the scientific truth. And what I'm discovering instead is that there's an endless proliferation of hypotheses for any set of data. There's no end to it. So how do you know which is the right hypothesis? How do you know to even what to test? You know, his 14-year-old mind just kind of can't handle this, and he's neglecting his homework, and he flunks out, and then when he's old enough, he joins the army, encounters some interesting people over in Korea who expose him to, for the first time in his life, to some Eastern ideas. All the way back on the troop ship, he's reading F.S.C. Northrop's The Meeting of the East and West, and this changed his life. When he got back, he re-enrolled in college, and now he's going to study philosophy and not science. He even goes to India to study Eastern philosophy. He gets no answers there. And he finally gives up all these big questions he has about, you know, what's true and what's right and how should we live. He gives up on all that as a young middle-aged man with a couple of kids. And this is when he goes to Bozeman to teach rhetoric. So by the time he gets there, he's forgotten about all that stuff. He's just settling into a comfortable middle-class lifestyle. And then this colleague of his ask him, are you teaching your students quality? He's a teacher of rhetoric, a teacher of composition 101, you know, it's just freshman. But because of his background, this question just blows his mind. And then this leads him to quit his job at Bozeman, and he goes to Chicago to study philosophy at the PhD level, to study the ancients, Plato and Aristotle and whatnot. And that's when he finally sort of reaches the answer that he's been looking for. That's when he... Well, either he goes insane and has a psychotic event, or he has an enlightenment experience, depending on how you look at it, depending on how you want to interpret it. And Persig himself says that he will not dispute either interpretation.
It's pitched in the book that the psychotic break was a direct result of the ideas involved.
Mm-hmm.
That they're so revolutionary and so mind-blowing that his mind was actually blown. And I find that just, it seemed like a bit of rhetorical drama to me. It did not, that,
exactly.
Not the way mental illness actually works. You don't, can get obsessed about certain, and he sounds like this at other points in the book, that now I can consider these ideas with a cool head and just kind of thresh out their philosophical implications. But back then I just fixed on this thing and just couldn't let it go. And it just occluded everything else. And clearly that's not a result of the idea itself then, because it's the same idea in both places, but it's what the mind that is grasping it is doing.
It's not clear to me that he doesn't struggle with getting obsessed by the idea again at the end, but I do want to say that that part of the book, it's a big book. There's sort of interspersed current time descriptions of the journey with his son and with this other couple, with these recollections about Phaedrus as he builds up the history and explains. It's almost two stories interwoven. But mm-hmm. the part where other teacher asks him if he's teaching quality, and he takes that question so seriously and it becomes this issue for him, I actually found that very charming and compelling.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because he's not sort of going to the textbooks or the history of philosophy to grapple with the traditional questions and problems and issues. He's just, this issue just comes up in the course of his work life. You know, he goes through a practical phase where he kind of works that out in the classroom. What does that mean in terms of writing essays? And then he goes into this philosophical phase where he's studying at the university. And then he goes into this mystical phase. And this is where we're supposed to believe, you know, where the insanity comes in. He comes to the conclusion, you know, late after the second book in discussions, that his work is a version of the perennial philosophy, which is, it's a kind of non-theistic mysticism when he gets to that final phase.
So we've talked about that on some of our episodes as the sort of apophatic moment. Every religion has a sort of a mystical branch or a mystical strain in it, such that, for instance, God is just so huge that there's nothing we can even say about him. And that even the word God is just a symbol, is an abstraction. But the truth of the religion is just something that is so primal and huge that all we can really do is sort of stand in awe of it and see how that affects our lives.
Maybe we should rewind a little bit and kind of build up to it. So we have kind of the outline of the story of the book. So let's talk a little bit about how he gets caught up in the idea of what it means to be teaching quality and why this becomes such a problem for him.
I have a suggestion to get at that question, which involves rewinding a little bit to just say a little bit about the very beginning of the journey, which would get to why the word motorcycle and maintenance is in the title.
Okay, sure.
The tie for me to that experience in Bozeman and the question of quality is brought up in sort of example in the discussion about tuning motorcycles and the way in which he engages in it and thinks about it and reflects on his own experience with it and what is good and bad about it alongside his friend John, who sort of refuses to do such things. And he frames this whole thing from the big picture view in this sort of romantic versus classical view, contrasting a kind of intuitive versus scientific. He has a number of buzzwords, jargony words about it. But what I found compelling was he was right about the way in which you pay attention to a machine. And I guess for me, it was the way in which he was attentive in a particular way to the behavior and the operation of it, with, on the one hand, a motion towards understanding and manipulating, but not with a point of view of conquering. So it was a displacement from the, you know, sort of the Baconian or Cartesian notion of science as conquering nature and making it submit to your intellect. But it came hand in hand with an understanding of manipulation and technique that was also coupled with a genuine sense of listening and attentiveness to sort of what was going on, both those things at the same time. I read this book before I started riding motorcycles, and then read it again after I started riding motorcycles, and then I read it again most recently. And I find that his description of that kind of interaction with the technical world and the way in which you are a successful mechanic was right on. And I think that has a lot to do with both the bridge that he wants to pose between science and philosophy and the way in which we interact with the world as a thing outside of ourselves, but also have an intellect with respect to.
I want to try to explain a little of the context there before. I guess the initial problem that's posed is this alienation that people often feel, especially in the hippie age when this was written. And I guess the ride itself was supposed to be taking place in 1968. So it was very much a buck the system, whatever. He uses the hip versus square.
That was the year of my birth, baby.
It was the year of my birth, too.
So, you know, he's talking about his friends that he's riding with and their technophobia, that's the way that they react to this being in a world with things that you no longer understand. He's saying, no, you can still be groovy and understand the technical details as well. In fact, it's a whole wonderland that is open to you. The beauty of the structure of something is just as groovy as the surface appearance is. It's kind of like the difference between letting the beat of a song just carry you and grooving it on that way and listening for how all the structure of the different instruments work together. The analysis doesn't have to ruin the experience for you. In fact, you can make it all the more rich. Yeah, and I thought you would be into this, Dylan. I was not surprised that you had read this multiple times, because Dylan, who is my brother-in-law, so I have some personal insight into his behavior, but this guy will like redo his kitchen himself, redo his porch himself. I can replace batteries on things. Like, I have no, but I see you as a guy that is just not afraid to unalienate himself from the tools around him.
Well, thank you.
Alienation is definitely the thing he's trying to counter here. He's talking about this identifying with the thing, which really kind of just means that you really give a shit. If you can't fix this thing, you're going to feel bad about it because you love the thing and you want to go someplace on it. And of course, the bike is just a metaphor for everything that you work on.
And I would stress not just the working on, but the attentiveness, the maintenance part of it. Right. So a big deal at the beginning of this book is the way in which he talks about the conflict between him and John taking care of their machines. Mm-hmm. And then you also read in the narrative about just his activity of doing this. He's riding along and he hears the sound of it. It just doesn't sound quite right. And he needs to make a judgment. Well, is that not sounding quite right because, well, we're at a higher altitude, and so the motorcycle is running the way it's supposed to, but it's sounding different because it's in a different environment? Or are the tappets loose because it actually needs to be tuned up differently? And should I manipulate it or give it some adjustment because I am at a higher altitude? That attentiveness to its own activity is what I find compelling. And the way he phrases it is my experience with the way any good mechanic actually behaves, or any good carpenter actually behaves, is a kind of constant feedback and listening to attentiveness to the activity. So when you hear a carpenter or sculptor talk about the sculpture came out of the stone, it's a kind of attentiveness to what fits for that particular situation. So in a carpenter or a mechanic, they'll walk into your house or have your car drive up. They'll say, oh, that's running really good. Or that sounds like your carburetor's running a little bit rich. Or they'll notice things about the way your house is constructed. And that's just part of their attentiveness to their surroundings. And then it becomes even heightened when they're actually partaking of that activity.
And it's important too, Dylan, that he's making an argument in favor of this attentiveness being available to us through technology.
Yes.
That in order to be attuned to things, you have to go back to nature. And he's saying, no, you can be attuned to technology. Technology is part of the organic structure of things.
You shouldn't be willfully ignorant. You're not going to be a better mechanic by imagining that the carburetor is like a woman and you're going to make love to the carburetor and therefore you'll understand it, right?
Is that how you understand women?
No, what I'm thinking of is it's a common trope for musicians in my experience about the kind of way in which you groove on learning how to play the instrument and you attend to it the way you would attend to a woman because it's a kind of sexual, mystical experience. And there's an attentiveness, but it's not one, as you're pointing out, it's not absent technology and techne in the sense of a artful application of practical knowledge.
This is the classic and romantic that he plays with throughout the text. And it's also the theoretic and the aesthetic. Those are the two main categories that he learned from Northrop, the meaning of the East and West. This is a guy from Yale, by the way, a pretty underrated dude. And Persick says that, you know, his book, Zen and the Art, is basically a popularization of Northrop's difficult book, which is just a huge monster of a thing. I've never read it. But he's popularizing something very specific. If you want to know the, you know, real meat and potatoes of what this guy is saying, you go read Northrop. There's no reason to, like his buddy John and like so many people in that era who were, you know, dressing like Indians and wanting to live in teepees and stuff like that. That is a total rejection of technology and intellect. There's something profoundly anti-intellectual about that. And he's trying to say, that's a symptom of a problem. And the problem is real. We got a cultural crisis going on here because there is something terribly square about our ways of thinking, about our technology, about our science. Something so square that it's alienating. It makes a lot of people very unhappy. They feel overwhelmed and out of control. And there's all these things everywhere they go that they don't understand. But he's saying running from that is not the way to go. He felt, because of his scientific background, that he could face this problem and come up with a solution.
We were talking about attentiveness. You could picture a very different story coming out of this, where he's talking about the attentiveness that he pays to his son and his companions and how he's so in tune to their needs and things. And I find it interesting that the way he's talking about this attentiveness, oh, you know, I understand it both on a romantic and classical levels and can merge those two, that those do not apply easily to people. Somebody who is like a psychoanalyst doesn't necessarily relate better to their child because they can, you know, understand them on an analytical level and sort of merging that with the affective. Those are just clearly very different things.
I sort of disagree, actually. I think that he understands, well, I mean, I guess we have the story only from his perspective, and it would make a difference to have it from Chris's perspective. And I'd have to think about whether or not he always misjudges what he should be doing. I mean, there are times when Chris just throws a tantrum, so he ignores the tantrum and lets the kid deal with it.
You know, the fact the book records the thoughts doesn't mean that that's all that was necessarily going on in the interactions between them. You know, that so you can't really draw that conclusion. But still, the fact is that he says he has trouble relating to other people, and that's what a lot of the story is about.
When the book ends, it's the triumphant ending, supposedly, is when Chris finally, the son, asks him, "Were you really insane?" And the narrator answers for the first time ever, "No, I wasn't. I wasn't insane. And, you know, everything I said was true." And at that point, he allows Chris to get back on the motorcycle, this time without the helmet. And this time, he doesn't even have to sit down. Chris is standing up as they're winding through the redwoods. And he realizes that, you know, this poor kid has just been staring at the back of my helmet through the whole trip. Of course he's not having a good time. You know, but now he's, you know, he's got this helmet off and the air is blowing through his hair and he's smelling everything. And he can see up ahead, you know, what's coming in the road. He's got the perspective of the driver for the first time instead of the back of somebody's coat and helmet. And so this is, I think, when the narrator finally sort of gives up that fraudulent personality and confesses, "No, I'm just doing this to stay out of the hospital, and he wasn't insane, and I believed what he said," and blah, blah. That's when Chris can sort of have some peace. That's when he gets his father back.
Maybe we should actually get to what his view of quality is. So we already talked about it as this indefinable, mystical thing that happens before any sort of analysis of experience. And we gave a few of the comparisons of that to Eastern and some of the Western folks. But he has much more to say about it than that. Because, I mean, just the fact that he calls it quality, it means it's not just this inexpressible thing. It has a value, a positive value or a negative value. And I was a little unclear. I mean, the word quality, he seems to talk about it like it's just a yes-no rating like that. But there's also the word qualia, with the qualitative character of things, which you could say, you know, you get an overall sense, which is not just a yay or nay. It's a very complicated, even if you don't want to say like it's broken into parts. It's unanalyzed, right? Do you think there's support in his writings that he definitely just means yay or nay, or could it be something else?
It's kind of like the unanalyzed totality is aesthetically charged, as you say, positive or negative. You know, this is really good. And then you figure out why it's really good later upon reflection.
But is it just the positive or negative, or does it have a character more specific than that?
I mean, you can't put your finger on it and articulate it, but it's a very specific feeling tone. Like I say, aesthetically charged. There's all kinds of grades in there. It's not just good or bad. It's all kinds of feelings.
So it does have more than just a positive or negative, though it does have that. It has lots of other characteristics. It's just you can't pick them out because it's unanalyzed, right? You don't know it by its properties. It's just something you experience directly.
Right. And I think the idea is, in the case of motorcycle maintenance or whatever else that you're working on, is you're not really seeing it or hearing it exactly, but you're in touch with this. You're following the quality. And, you know, this doesn't exclude thought. And when I say it's unanalyzed or pre-intellectual, I don't mean that, you know, there's a total absence of thought. But you're, you know, the front edge of your experience is sort of what's dominating.
Could I read I have a quote from chapter 20 on what you're saying, if that's all right.
Please.
Text? What are you?
He says, this is in chapter 20, at the cutting edge of time, there must be a kind of non-intellectual awareness, which he called awareness of quality. You can't be aware that you've seen a tree until after you've seen the tree. And between the instant of vision and instant of awareness, there must be a time lag. The past exists only in our memories, the future only in our plans. The present is our only reality. The tree that you are aware of intellectually, because of that small time lag, is always in the past and therefore is always unreal. Any intellectually conceived object is always in the past and therefore unreal. Reality is always the moment of vision before the intellectualization takes place. There is no other reality. Since all intellectually identifiable things must emerge from this pre-intellectual reality, quality is the parent, the source of all subjects and objects. And there's a lot stuffed into there. Everything that we say we see or hear is already, he says, in the past. It is already involves an intellectual component, which other philosophers we've read have put that as something like there's no such thing as unconceptualized experience or something like that. All experience is of something in particular. I have experienced this tree. Okay, well, that means the concept of tree and the concept of spatial object and all this stuff is already built into that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he's denying that. He's saying, yes, that's what thinking is about, but a key part of experience, moment to moment, in fact, the key part of experience is this pre-intellectual stuff. Yeah, I'm not sure I buy that.
Well, Here's the thing, though. He works his way into it, though. The conversation starts, at least from my perspective, it starts with epistemology. He has the entire class write essays, and then he reads the essays to the entire class. He's asking all of these quote-unquote naive freshman rhetoric students, can you tell which of these are good and which of these are bad? Which of these have quality and which of these don't have quality? And they can. The students know which are good essays and which are bad essays. And then he says, okay, well, why are these good and why are these bad? And this is where the problem comes into play. They're unable to reach a definition or a set of criteria which are coherent and consistent across all of the cases to say, this is what makes a good essay and this is what doesn't. And yet they are able to identify it. And this is kind of the source of the conundrum.
Well, he convinces the students that they do know what quality is, even though they can't define it, through that exercise that you mentioned. Exactly. And so once he's got them convinced of that, then all he has to say is, well, your goal is to write an excellent essay. And they say, well, how do I do that? I don't know how to do that. And he says, yeah, you do. You know exactly what excellent is. He wants to reverse the priority. He wants the aesthetic to come before the theoretic. He even says at one point that, in my opinion, all the rules of grammar and essay writing, all the criteria that's supposed to be a mark of great literature, all this stuff was invented after the fact. First, there was the great writing, and then people develop rules from that. The primary thing is the excellence that everybody recognizes, even if they can't say why. And then some people can work out why. In fact, there's this pithy little quote. What does he say? First you get the feeling, then you figure out why.
I agree that there would be a kind of, for lack of a better term, a pre-intellectual experience. But it's utterly key, isn't it, that the writing comes before the formulation of a strict set of rules about it. And it turns out that set of rules ends up being a kind of pale reflection of the original. It doesn't capture the richness of that original material. There's experience embedded in there in some way, your experience with literature. On the face of it, while I understand the notion that, well, these students, they know what quality is. They know what the quality of these essays are, and they can judge it by pointing out to it. And you see the evidence of it because there's a kind of general ascension about it. Okay, I can buy that. But if I ask them all to go judge whether or not, well, let's just say a motorcycle is operating correctly, they're not going to be able to do that. Unless they get some experience with that, they're going to have to go take it for a ride. They're going to have to do all kinds of things and gather experience with it. And then maybe based upon that, they're going to formulate a judgment about that quality. But it seems to me there's got to be something happening, and it's not clear to me that it's exactly pre-intellectual about processing that experience. And maybe that's what he means by the quality, but it's not clear to me that it's as simple as it being manifest in, oh, any freshman can judge whether it's good writing or not. Because that has, along with it, a whole bunch of baggage about their own experience with writing.
Which he admits, but yeah, I have trouble also reconciling that with the notion that these judgments are pre-intellectual. You have to recognize that it is an essay in order to judge that it's a good essay. You have to understand the language. There's so many things intellectually that are going into before this judgment comes up that to say this has anything to do with the pre-intellectual just seems strange to me.
This is an excellent point. I've heard this objection many times, and I don't know if I've really come up with a very good reply to it. But there's a point where he uses a train as an analogy for the difference between theoretic knowledge, the things that you know, conceptual ideas and all that stuff, and then this pre-intellectual cutting-edge experience. He asks us to imagine a huge freight train moving across the landscape, and this thing is like a mile long, and all the boxcars are filled with all the concepts that we've inherited from the past, that we inherit from the language, you know, the context of our culture. And that freight, that's got a lot of momentum, a lot of weight behind it. But at the cutting edge of that train, that's the pre-intellectual experience. And there's something about that whole train behind the front edge that informs the way you take the present moment. In other words, the present moment, that dynamic cutting edge of experience, that pre-intellectual experience, is well-funded not only by your own personal experience, but also by the collective experience of the culture in which you learn to think and speak. So you have a mile-long train full of freight, and that always comes to bear on the present moment. Like you say, you know, a motorcycle mechanic, he's got to know how to use the tools, he's got to know what the shape of this machine is, what it can do on the road. He's got to have a lot of experience with motorcycles and machines to be a good enough motorcycle repairman to be considered an artist. That's what he's trying to do, is, you know, raise even that kind of seemingly mundane task to the level of an art by being engaged in it, identifying with it.
And that sounds right, but it's not clear to me that the way in which it cleaves is between intellectual and pre-intellectual. It might be a refinement of the intellectual and all the stuff we've mentioned about attentiveness, or the way in which you understand your engagement and the status of that engagement with the external world and your experience and the contingency of that. That may all take a different tenor, maybe, than other ways of speaking about it. But it seems to me that it's ripe for the objection that that is somehow a refinement of intellectual experience and not a pointing to something that is non-intellectual. That, you know, whatever this sort of sixth sense is, it's something that comes out of mind and comes out of our being that's at least aside from or alongside our sort of rote psychochemical experiences of like our eyes and our ears and our noses.
I'm going to try to avoid name dropping, but the reason I wanted to go back to this idea of how it comes organically out of the epistemology is that what I thought of first when I was reading this was Wittgenstein. So Wittgenstein has this idea in the later works that he talks about game and trying to define what a game is. Everybody can identify, everybody can see whether or not something is a game. But when you try to actually define and set down the rules for what counts as a game and what doesn't, it becomes somewhat difficult. So what I thought when I first read this part about the students being able to identify something but not being able to define exactly what it was, I wasn't thinking so much in terms of concept, pre-concept, and what gets on to the metaphysics, but more about that it was somehow linguistic, or that experiential knowledge versus what we would consider, you know, traditional knowledge, something like that.
it seems to me that Wittgenstein and Persig are both making an anti-essentialist move. This idea that, you know, a thing can only be that certain thing, and there's an essential meaning that, you know, things just are what they are, and our task is to find out what they are. But Persig is saying, and I think Wittgenstein is saying, language doesn't work like that.
It doesn't map onto pre-established substances or something like that.
Right, right.
Pre-established categories.
It doesn't match onto the way reality is already carved out, some pre-existing ontology that we don't have any particular access to, and we're trying to find out what's really real. And I think Persig, for sure, is saying, no, definitions are just abstractions. They're just what we find most salient about a whole series of experiences. There is no essence of anything. There's no true nature of anything. We're making this up as we go along. We're inventing all this stuff. We invent the concepts and the words, and they're pale by comparison to the experience from which they're abstracted. The real reality is so much richer than words and abstractions and ideas.
And he extends that to concepts like space and time, or at least space. He talks specifically about Poincaré and his dealing with non-Euclidean geometry. So you might think that we have this sort of self-evident experience of space, and so mathematicians, geometers can abstract from that and create some axioms that have to hold or something. Gives the example of the discovery of, well, you could have non-Euclidean geometries where parallel lines, in fact, do meet at infinity as opposed to going on forever and not meeting. And there's nothing inconsistent about that. And so the world itself underdetermines its various abstractions, that you can always come up with more than one description of these things. So don't think that any concept, even such a basic one, and seemingly codifiable one is space, can be captured like this. And you could do something similar, I think, with the concept of number. If you listen to our Russell on Mathematics episode, I mean, you can consider numbers as sets. You could get into the different types of numbers. Even that, there's a lot of room for different theories of these supposedly self-evident things about experience.
Yeah, in that moment, he's talking about two new geometries in addition to the traditional, you know, Newtonian three-dimensional space, the commonsensical geometry where parallel lines never intersect and all that stuff. There's two alternatives, and they work in their own domains. And at that point, he says, you know, geometry is not true so much as it's convenient. It's useful. It gets you somewhere. This is the most pragmatic moment in his first book, where he's saying that, you know, the truth and value and validity of an idea is its ability to function in your experience. Does it work? And obviously, these alternative geometries were actually doing some real work in physics. It's beyond my understanding, but
I'm going to refer listeners to our William James episodes that we did a while back on the meaning of truth for discussion of this in general. But what about, let's see what specifically Persig has to add to this.
I was thinking that the way Persig would add to it, it just goes back to this key term of quality, that this is going to be the vector along which you're going to make distinctions and have them stick. And I was trying to sort out for myself what the content of that naming of that distinction as quality is. So when you use that kind of pragmatist language and say that you're going to make a distinction between it working and not working, it seems to me that Persig calls that fittingness, that appropriateness, that the thing that you're really making distinction based on is what he's going to call quality. Even if we want to try to cling to something about it being ephemeral is the wrong word. I think he would steadfastly say that it's not ephemeral. It's not transitory exactly. It might be hard to get a hold of because it's not essential and it's not substantial. But it's nonetheless the characteristic that we have to make these distinctions. I'm trying to figure out the words to get across why quality is the word that he wants to pick. I mean, I assume it is just a way of saying it, a difference between better and worse.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of, at the end of the day, when you're making a judgment about something, that this is better and worse, it's more fitting and not fitting, that's the way this word quality is operating. And as David was saying, it fits in with all your experience, all your cultural baggage, all those things all together.
And I know we've made the point in a number of ways in different discussions of the relation between fact and value in terms of no analysis of facts is going to give you a goal. Even if you say these two puzzle pieces fit together just right, you don't care unless you want to fit the puzzle pieces together. Why you'd even call it fitness at all is because there's some sort of preconception of an aesthetic desire that these look good together, or we're trying to achieve something with that or something like that. There's always some quality judgment that is prior to your analysis of the facts. He really gets it down to an ontological level, that what the fact that I call this a puzzle piece and this a puzzle piece, as opposed to referring to the background behind them or the piece of lint that's over to the side, what we pick out as objects at all is going to be a pragmatic matter. It's going to be a judgment of quality, according to him.
Actually, this gets really complicated. William James was a psychologist, as you probably know, before he became a philosopher. And he and Persig both get into this idea that there's a pre-selection process that goes on, that you select what to notice from the flux of experience, you know, this overwhelming, over-buzzing, blooming confusion of experience. And so there's huge parts of reality that you never even become consciously aware of because they have no value to you. They don't make any difference to you, which is kind of a weird idea, you know, that there's, I don't know what percentage of reality is filtered out by our eyes, for example. You know, there's only a certain segment of the electromagnetic spectrum that we can see. And
well, that's,
so,
that's different from it being irrelevant to us. That's not the same issue at all.
Well, that's right? True, but the idea is that certain things are just beyond our, the very organs of perception frustrate our ability to truly perceive reality in its totality, that we're always going to be limited by our concepts as well as our sense organs.
Isn't it a better example than something like what our sense organs don't see would be the things that we're embedded in and we're so embedded in them as to ignore them, like the air or gravitational attraction or our country.
Our own bodies, yeah.
Our own bodies. I mean, all those things that we are utterly embedded in that we don't pay attention to, usually until we strike up against some kind of boundary that forces us to then pay attention to them. So we leave our country, then we begin to reflect on our own country. And when maybe we're ill, we begin to think about our healthfulness, and that it's upon those transitions that we become aware that there's a difference. And I guess in Pirzig's language, we'd say, well, there's a difference in quality. We've gathered an experience that allows us to make a distinction between this and that, and we're going to make some classifications isn't quite the right word, but some distinctions of quality and distinctions in general. And they may not have hard and fast categories yet, but they will have differences of quality that we will point to and reflect on and factor into our experience, and then that will educate our future experience.
Well, most of what you just said was Heidegger speak, right? That there's
it
this
was?
Background.
Okay.
Yes, it's this background of conditions that we are living in. You don't notice the tool until the tool malfunctions. Mm-hmm. You don't notice your hand until your hand hurts or is not doing what it's supposed to do. You don't notice gravity until you have a run-in with it. I don't see how Pirzig's notion of quality helps to clarify that insight. So this is, again, Heidegger's example, that if I'm using the hammer successfully, I don't notice it. It's only when the hammer breaks that my attention focuses on it. Well, I mean, you could say, okay, because a bad quality thing happened there or something, and so I noticed it. Mm-hmm. But actually, that goes right against what we were just saying before, that we notice the things that have good quality. In fact, he sort of tries to generalize this notion of quality to be a complete metaphysical, you know, we don't even need the notion of causation anymore, because we could just think of it in terms of quality. You know, to say A causes B, you could say B as a positive quality assessment of A or something. In other words, when A happens, B tends to show up as well, because there's a quality relation there. If you're going to be that expansive about this notion of quality, it really should do something, and it has to be in some way linkable back to what it is in our experience, right, of seeing something as good or bad. And I don't see that here, even in the hammer example.
You don't really need to get reflective or think in terms of abstractions if you're operating unproblematically. If everything is smooth and works, it's sort of all just taken for granted. And the hammerhead falls off, or when you all of a sudden realize that there's a contradiction in your thinking, it doesn't have to be a tangible physical thing, of course. You sort of crash, and then you're forced to reflect. Dewey talked about that, where thinking is where you're taken out of the stream of experience for a while, and you have to look down on where you were and what went wrong. And the smoothness of operation is sort of the natural sweet spot to be in. Thinking is really about solving problems that we encounter when that experience is not smooth.
I'm trying to figure out whether you've answered my question or not, because you kind of just restated the same Heidegger point, but you certainly stated it in terms that sound like what Persig would say. What I'm trying to picture is just this notion of, again, back to the basic act of perception, that I divide some perception up analytically, partly out of habit, of course, right? We see things as subjects and objects out of habit. But he seems to think that we notice the things we do for some quality reason. That just seems that that's not a powerful enough way of explaining the way perception works, right? Object recognition comes out of usefulness. So I guess then we have to analyze the hammer example is when it breaks, it then becomes useful for us to actually consider the hammer because we didn't have to before. It was not necessary. It was not useful for us to be focusing on the hammer, to be self-conscious about it because it was going smoothly, but now we have to. So it is a quality distinction. It's just, it makes sense putting in terms of utility, but I didn't use the word quality there. Unless you want to just say utility and quality are identical, in which case he's adding nothing at all to the pragmatists, and I'm not convinced of that either.
I guess utility would be one species of quality. And he wants to make it very, very broad so that, when he was back in Bozeman, he was being pressed for explanations from his colleagues. And apparently they tended to think in terms of behaviorist psychology, because this was 1960. And so he tried to explain, you know, if you put a little bit of acid in the water drop with the amoeba in it, the amoeba is going to run away from that acid.
Yep.
And if the amoeba had a mind and had words, it would invent all kinds of analogies for why the acid is bad and evil and why we have to get away from it and stuff like that. And he's saying quality is this basic stimulus that is the engine of all evolutionary adaptation and growth.
Well, yeah, and I think you're getting at exactly how to judge whether what Persig is adding to the pragmatist project makes any sense. He wants to not only just make this point about human functioning, but make this across-the-board metaphysical statement about, you know, it's almost like Hegel's thesis, antithesis, synthesis, you know, that there's these patterns that are just everywhere in the world. And so we could analyze all this stuff in terms of quality. And I don't see any reason why it is particularly helpful to see the sort of causality that makes the amoeba move away from my own very complex analysis of a situation where I see this is aesthetically displeasing or dangerous or something, and I move away. I'm not sure that there's anything but a surface level similarity between those.
So what have we covered, and what do you think there still is to be covered?
I think that we hit a lot of the big ideas, and what we've been struggling with the past little bit is two things. One, what sort of distinction does this notion of quality make that is different, either genuinely different or at least different in flavor than other kinds of similar distinctions that we know about in Western philosophy, be it Heidegger or Wittgenstein or other sorts of things. And we were sort of going down that route, especially with respect to pragmatism. And the other was trying to get a hold of what this non-essentialist pragmatist view would be. And there we're running into the same kind of problem that we run in with the pragmatists in general, is that as a kind of phenomenology of experience, there's a lot be sympathetic with. And the problem comes in articulating the way in which those distinctions are working so that they provide us with real information about the world, which is the contention, right? That may be hard to articulate what they are, but in fact, we are getting real information about the world that way. And we're, I think, struggling with that in the same way that we've struggled with it in the past with the pragmatists, and then looking a little bit back and a little bit forward with Wittgenstein, a similar kind of trying to get a handle on what we're saying when we make distinctions of quality or difference or rankings and that kind of thing. And also at the same time saying that they're not essentialist.
The new element is the aesthetic here. Why he's calling it quality as opposed to fitness or something else is that, that this really is the same thing. Why we do anything. And I would add to that list of comparisons, Nietzsche's will to power, or we talked about Foucault's notion of power in our last discussion, where pretty much anytime anything influences you, we say that's a micro power. That's just a little bit of power being exerted, in which he was using it in such a diffuse way that it's just like Perzig's quality. It's sort of the glue that holds everything together, or at least all human experience. And so I had thought maybe that also what was unique about Persig is that he's trying to extend this way down even to talking about atoms and just the fact that you're using aesthetics. He explicitly wants to connect philosophy of art and philosophy of science together by saying that you can unite them in the same thing. And I'm not sure that I get it, that I see why these, yes, there is an analogy there, but it doesn't seem to be a strict enough analogy to be particularly useful.
Probably the most comparable concept in philosophy, as far as I know, between quality, Persig's quality, and anything else, would be William James's idea of pure experience. And even there, you're going to have to push James a little bit to make him into Persigian, if you will.
Well, why would an amoeba have a pure experience? Like, James is using phenomenology, which is a word that I don't see in this book anywhere. And a lot of this, you know, Merleau-Ponty, a lot of these other folks that we're doing, that's a phenomenological feature. If you want to say that this whole discussion of the preconceptual moment of experience, and I don't know that I buy his picture. I kind of prefer the idea that for anything to get experienced at all, it gets experienced through concept. It's not that we, on top of that, have this preconceptual experience that then we are conscious of putting in concepts in any way. That doesn't ring true to me. But at the same time, by adding the aesthetic quality to it, the aesthetic notion, there's something that rings true about it.
I'm perfectly comfortable with extrapolating it down to amoebas or down to rocks in the following sense that, first of all, you're going to want to do that if you believe that the consciousness that we have is somehow naturally born out of the activity of other entities, other things in the world, that we are evolutionary products.
Right. So consciousness is never completely absent from reality. It just sort of evolves along with everything else. It doesn't just, you know, appear on the scene at some point, you know, like 3.5 billion years into the evolution of the universe. All of a sudden, boom, consciousness appears. Experience appears. No, he wants to say it goes all the way down.
There's proto-consciousness, right.
This is the reason he postulates it.
Yeah, but you need to be really careful here, because if you want to say that, I think I'd be willing to go a long ways in this direction. But you do want to say, well, okay, look, what you mean by experience for a rock or for an atom or for an amoeba is going to be different, have at least some important differences than what you mean by experience for a dog or a human being.
Oh, yeah.
So articulating both what the differences are and what you mean by saying that there's something similar about that, I guess I can see where Pierzig's going to go in the sense of saying, we used this amoeba example before, that why does the amoeba go from one direction to another? And I think it's going to be maybe more illustrative to even pick something that's not even on the edge of being a living creature. To really push it, you say, well, why does one electron go away from another electron? And the way Pierzig's going to want to talk about that is going to have to do with something like the quality of the space-time continuum as a result of the presence of the electron that changes the quality of the, a physicist would say, the field around it, and these individual entities react to that field and the characteristic that makes them change their direction in response to that field is essentially quality.
I actually have a quote I can give to how he actually says that. This is from his book Lila, his follow-up book, 103 to 104. In the metaphysics of quality, causation is a metaphysical term that can be replaced by value. To say that A causes B, or to say that B values precondition A, is to say the same thing. The difference is one of words only. Instead of saying a magnet causes iron filings to move toward it, you can say iron filings value movement toward a magnet.
Okay, so there you go.
Scientifically speaking, yeah.
So I haven't even read Lila, and that's what I would have guessed what he would have said. So
Yep.
Yeah, elsewhere he makes a similar point. He says, the laboratory data is exactly the same. Whether you describe the behavior of atoms according to laws of causality, or whether you describe it in terms of they do what they do because they prefer to do it, it doesn't really matter. Again, that's just words. They're just two different ways to think about the empirical facts.
It's also that we don't understand. The reason we think causality is so attractive to us is because we think, oh, there's some sort of necessary connection. This thing makes that thing happen. But of course, and Persig references this, as Hume has pointed out,
right,
we don't actually understand causality. It's just one thing happens and then another thing happens. And we observe some regularities in that. So, well, why not call it the second thing prefers the precondition of the first thing? And in fact, he says that's more accurate when it comes to the quantum level. When we are just talking in probabilities, that it's not that there's a strict causality, it seems, everywhere. It's that it is likely that the particle will be emitted by the nucleus at this point, but it's not necessarily a strict causal thing. So just talk about it as preferences. Don't feel weird about stretching that, because you're talking about one process. You know, you're talking about one event. We usually think of agents preferring things, but it's going to be events preferring other events, which is, it's pretty wacky.
Well, that's certainly the way physicists and mechanics talk about it, right? When you talk about tuning up an engine, you would say that, well, it really wants to be there. I'll give you, I mean, an example for me, just because this book, Motorcycles, are on my mind, is my first experience with riding a high-performance motorcycle was when I took a BMW R80 or something like that about 8 or 10 years ago out on a test ride. And this was a new model that just come out as a sport bike. And I had, you know, was riding my old 1973 750. And you know, that bike, you know, it's perfectly fine. And it, you know, it'll go 100 miles an hour. But I get the sport bike and I get on the highway. And I'm going along just to get to the on-ramp. And I'm going 60 miles an hour in second gear. And I don't even really notice it. And then I get on the highway and I just go first, second, third gear, and I'm going 95 miles an hour. And I don't even really feel like I'm really moving. So I get going and I'm going for a few miles. And the motorcycle really, I try riding it at 60 miles an hour. And it just doesn't want to be there. And that's the only way I would say it. I say it just doesn't want to sit at 60 miles an hour. It really wants to sit at 110. In this case, the way I would manifest the problem with it is that when you ride it around in the city the whole time, because you're only going 30 miles an hour, is it constantly feels like it's just like a giant dog on a chain dragging you down the street and wanting to do something else.
It has too much power for this world.
Yeah, and I'm trying to use this language, or consciously use this language, of what it wants to do and whether it's behaving in a way that's natural to itself. Or when we say the electron wants to have other positrons around it and it doesn't want to have other electrons. Or we talk about energy levels in an atom and we say, well, if I excite the hydrogen atom and raise the electron up to another level, well, it really doesn't want to be there. It's going to go down to the lowest energy level. It's going to emit some other photons because everything wants to be at the lowest energy level. And that's exactly the way physicists still talk about it.
It does make sense to talk about things that way, doesn't it? I mean, it's not crazy.
It's just teleological talk, which is, you know, has a long history back to Aristotle. And scientists now don't mind using it as long as they understand. They're explicitly saying this is a metaphor. This is a shorthand way of talking about this.
Yeah, you don't want to anthropomorphize. It's not like subatomic particles can have self-consciousness and they make decisions about what's better than what. He wants to make this postulate, for example, because, say, the classical problem of free will is construed as a bottom-up reasoning, wherein atoms and molecules and chemistry all act according to the laws of causality, and so you extrapolate upward to humanity. Human beings must be subjects of cause and effect, too. And Persig says it's just as reasonable to go the other way. Chemistry professors make decisions and they have free will. Since their body is composed of atoms and molecules, well, atoms and molecules must have free will too. There's free will all the way down, except that it gets more and more free as you evolve. We are freer than atoms. In fact, atoms and molecules are so unfree. Their patterns of preference are so consistent that we might as well think of them in terms of laws. gravity always obtains. So it makes sense to think of it as a law. But really, we invented that based on the observation of things in the real world, and it's an abstraction. It's a metaphysical entity, gravity. The same as causality. And so many things that we believe in, commonsensically and scientifically, as the truth, are really just stuff we made up.
Maybe a more live option is thinking about animals. Descartes himself thought animals were just like clockworks, that, you know, the strict causality didn't have any sort of inner experience. And you could really reflect on that. You could sort of see it. The animal's obeying its instincts. It's obeying the chemical laws it's subject to. But still, when you're dealing with your dog or something, it seems free in much the same way that a human being is. You know, it doesn't stop and consider things the way we do, but there's some essence there that's still going there. And if you can hold both those things in your mind, that it really is acting free, yet you can see much more clearly with an animal than you can with a human being how it's determined, then you shouldn't be worried so much about the other cases.
Yeah, I mean, a dog knows what a newspaper is when you hit him with it, but he's not going to read it. He's not going to know its meaning in the culture. But it's an object that he can perceive the same way we do. This little dog is probably going to run from the newspaper as something that's painful.
Is what's essential to the freedom there, then? It seems free because we think of him as perceiving that this is a newspaper and registering what that means and kind of making a choice to run away or something. Then that analogy would not hold to the subatomic level, to things that are obviously mechanistic.
Mm.
Let's do some closings. For my closing, if I can just go ahead, is besides saying thanks, Dave, it was really great having you here.
Great to be here. I enjoyed it immensely.
I guess one of the things that we didn't really touch on here, this should be a really attractive book for us, given the premise of this podcast, because we said he had some philosophy training and things. He went to school, but he purposefully shuns academia. I mean, he describes them as not philosophers, but philosophological? Right. Mm. Like musicologists.
Philosophologists studying philosophology.
People that study the history of philosophy, but don't actually think for themselves. So that's from Lila where he goes into that. But in this book, you see that in just his dealing with his professors in the later section of the book where he's talking about his just his inability to. Now, he's so consumed with his own intellectual development that he does not have the patience to take Aristotle's point of view as presented in the Poetics, for instance. To put himself, you know, we try on this podcast to really throw ourselves into these other works and sort of see where that bounces around for us. And I think that's what academia gives you. It gives you the patience to that. So that's maybe how I think, even though we are not in academia right now, because we went through that, maybe we're victims of what Persig thinks that academics are, that we end up talking too much about what these other people think and not voicing our own opinions. I think that's more just because it's really hard to formulate your own philosophy. But we're all independently doing that. And if you listen to lots of episodes, you can hear these sort of ideas that I think all of us are individually or collectively throwing around, evolving.
This is my favorite part of the podcast, by the way. You know, you can definitely hear attitudes and dispositions and in the tone between the lines. You can hear that there's personalities are reacting to these ideas. They have feelings about it. That, to me, is the beauty of the podcast. And, that, and as a matter of fact, I would say that you guys are the best at doing a philosophy podcast for exactly that reason. It sort of lives. You know, it's spontaneous. It's a conversation. This is why Plato wrote in dialogue form, right? This is like philosophical porn. His idea was that, you know, the real thing
is to
engage in conversation with actual people. To just read a text by yourself, that's like porn. That just gets you in the mood for some real hot philosophy action.
I would not have thought that my impatience with Wes would have been characterized as porn.
I think the by yourself is porn. This is actual intercourse. What we're doing is verbal fucking on you. There's the explicit tag right there.
I find myself taking sides based strictly on the tone of your voice.
Thank you for the compliment. I mean, so Persig, I think he has a quote in here I found. Pretty much this explains why he wrote the book like this, why he didn't just write a 20-page treatise, which he can do. I found on the web, he's given presentations and things and just here's what quality is and here's how it can address problems in physics or something like that. But why this is put in a novel form, my cynical answer while I was reading is because that's all he was capable of. In fact, on our website, you can find I wrote a book just after college called Tripe that is kind of the same thing. Yeah, you know, it eventually gets around to some sort of philosophy or some sort of novelistic aspects, but it's really because I just don't have the patience to sit down and write something with a proper form. And so it's just this diarrhea of the, you know, it's like a bunch of blog posts strung together or something.
I'm going to take that as self-deprecating humor.
Yeah, so I sympathize with him for putting in this form, and I don't think it's an accident. I don't think it's merely a matter of that he thinks this is the best possible way to present his ideas. I think this is just what he can actually do, what is natural for him. He needs to talk about himself thinking about the ideas rather than just talking about the ideas. But on the other hand, he has this quote here. This is from he's having a conversation with these people he's visiting, and they say, oh, you should write this stuff in a book. And he says, the trouble is that essays have to sound like God talking for eternity, and that isn't the way it ever is. People should see that it's never anything other than just one person talking from one place in time and space and circumstance.
Mm-hmm. Philosophy is biography. Philosophical problems shouldn't come out of a textbook. They should come out of your own life. Sort of the main goal of this radical empiricism that he adopts from William James is to ditch a bunch of fake philosophical problems, like doubting your own existence. I mean, come on, how ridiculous is that, really?
Well, I would say that he
don't let yourself be baited. It's a closing. It's
yeah.
Well, if I'm going to do a closing, may I say that at a certain moment in the book, Persig says, you know, I haven't done anything for quality. Quality is just fine without any help from me. What I want to do is to expand rationality at its roots. Western rationality has this empty, hollow, vacuous thing about it that's killing us. We've got to put the affective domain back into philosophy. We have to admit that our feelings play a role and that they provide us with real information. It's about getting quality to be included in the way we think. It's about improving rationality, which he thinks is brittle and trivial and small. It should be more richly informed, well, by the heart. For lack of a better word.
It's the mechanics. Like, you can conquer the mechanics. You can learn how the motorcycle works. You shouldn't think that for any given enterprise, including intellectual enterprises, the whole point is to, say, for philosophy, academic philosophers, they just have to learn the history of philosophy. And that's kind of like all these classifications and all these details. And once you've waited in that for 100 years and learned everything, then finally you can sort of come up with ideas. He thinks, no, a better way to engage with philosophy is to have some idea that you already sort of hold dear and are trying to test its mettle, and then you reflect it against things that you're coming into experience with. So you already have the motivator, the quality thing there from the start. And that's how we need to interact with technology. That's how we need to interact with our jobs. We need to do our best at all times, agree with the goal, not be alienated from the goal. And just with our lives, there are just too many things that we do that we've sort of forgotten the point of, and we get lost in the details of it, and we might get scared by the details or alienated from the details, or in any case, we're not keeping clearly in mind what's really important.
That's it. I think it's a very simple humanitarian message. What he's saying, you hear all the time in little folk wisdom sayings and in religious sayings, you know, if you don't take them too literally, the stuff he's saying is not new. William James called pragmatism a new name for some very old ideas. With every new group of people, you have to make that live again. Otherwise, it's just a fossil, you know?
Seth, are you awake enough to give a closing?
Yeah. So I told some people I know yesterday that we were going to record on this tonight. And one of the guys said, "What is that? Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance." And the rest of us at the table looked at him in shock and disbelief. This book is kind of like Catch-22 or One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest or Fear and Loathing, right? It's a cultural icon. It's words that almost everybody knows, these seven words together. But I don't know how many people have actually read the book. And I certainly was not one of them. It's not at all what I expected. I thought it was going to have something to do with Zen, and I thought it was going to have something to do with motorcycle maintenance, and it really isn't about either one of those things. It's a very interesting prose style that he employs to try to make this point, if you will, or tell this story, or both. The idea of these intertwining narratives of something that's happening sort of in the past and being retold, and something that's happening in the present that's being lived and experienced at that time that the writing, and you have sort of two characters in the book as well, the sort of historical protagonist and the current or real-time protagonist. And I suspect that that style somehow informs the point of the book in a way that I didn't quite get, because my reading of the book was very much follow this telling of the book. I didn't jump to William James. I didn't jump to metaphysics. I sort of went with the flow of the book and tried to follow the line of thinking as it was articulated through the experiences of the protagonist. And I suspect, as we sit here and I was listening to you guys argue back and forth, or not argue, because I'm not quite sure if you were agreeing or disagreeing on a lot of things, I wonder if it isn't either intentional or also necessary to kind of experience the development of the idea in the book in the way that it is done in order to kind of get the significance of it, or to have some kind of meaningful grasp of what he's trying to drive at. And that may very well be the case, because there were definitely plenty of points of time while I was listening to it in audiobook form and then rereading certain passages where it was just painful. It just seemed like, oh, get to the point, right? Sort of like what Mark was saying. Why write in this style as opposed to just saying it? And while I was listening to it, I think I got into it, but sitting here trying to discuss it in kind of our format, something's a little bit lost and I'm not quite sure what it is.
It's quality, man. It's lost.
It could very well be.
Dylan, are you still with us?
Oh, sure.
Bring it home.
Okay. I was very interested and kind of excited about talking about this book. I hadn't thought about it in a long, long time, but I, like I said earlier, I had read it a long time ago and read it a few times. Thinking about what Seth just said about the way in which it's written, I guess for me, in large part, the way in which it's narrative and encapsulating the experience of coming to these conclusions, in particular the fact that this whole story is him going back to Bozeman and then beyond and rethinking through and remembering sort of his previous life and understanding for himself that he's different than he was, but also understanding that he's stepping off somehow from where Phaedrus left off and trying to reflect on the character and content of Phaedrus's work, his sort of previous life, I think is fundamental to the way the book works and the way in which experience ends up informing what you understand now, but is also not simply encapsulating what you know now, that it's a constant dynamic activity and that it gets refined and you learn from it and you can go in new directions and incorporate new experiences along the way. So for me, the aptness of it, particularly with respect to the way in which, at least myself, bring understanding of the physical world and then working in the world together, it rings in large part just true phenomenologically, the way pragmatism also just rings true for me phenomenologically. And I struggle with a way to articulate what it is exactly that's the distinctions being pointed to, but I still just can't shake the way in which it phenomenologically resonates with my own experience about, in this case, technology and science, as well as the world itself, and synthesizing those two, and the way in which, for lack of a better term, a kind of aesthetic judgment is fundamental bearing in the construction of my understanding of that interaction and processing that interaction.
I like the phenomenological aspects of this too. And I, even though I do not well exemplify his, you know, being patient with your tools while you're working, I mean, I can screw up even the most rudimentary household repair jobs. They'll say things like, make sure you have the right tool. In fact, go get some welding material and make your own tools if you can. Like, no, I will use the thing that is in my hand. I'm too impatient to go look around the garage for the appropriate one. You know, so there's a certain patience that he preaches that I recognize the value of in that I don't have it.
But you do, about the things that you care about. Doing this podcast, say, and your band, those are the things you care about. And those are the things that you really engage with and identify with.
Put some of yourself in what you do. Try to make it artistic. Try to actually engage in what you're doing instead of just rote doing what you've been told or something that you don't fully understand. That's a great humanistic message. If that's all that people get out of it, that's great. It's just when he gets beyond that and says, this is the all new thing that merges East and West, and it's the be all and end all explanatory basic metaphysical unit. He's lost me there.
I have to say, this is, I think, where the Zen comes in. You know, this drop your pretensions, drop all your fancy ideas, just chop wood, carry water, take care of your shit. Just be in your world, be where you are. Like the quote you used before, the present moment is really the only thing that's real. He's just trying to get you to focus on right now, right here.
Yeah, I don't actually buy that.
That is in deep contrast to the aesthetic and the way in which you pay attention to the way the world's working, which even if you may be in the moment, right, it's a kind of nexus of the past and future, and there's this constant dynamic. The whole notion of attentiveness that he explicates earlier in the book and at several points really relies on the fact that even if we can't attach causality to it, even if continuity isn't exactly the right word, there's a seamlessness between the past, the present, and the future that is a constant motion and dynamic. I mean, it's Heraclitean, for lack of a better term, or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that all requires that it be much, much more than distilled down to a this moment, but actually has tendrils into the past and into the future at all times.
I think that's right. Yeah.
But then that's the only way you could tune a motorcycle, and that's the only way you could think about quality.
That's kind of what I was trying to say earlier by bringing up that train analogy. There's all that freight, your personal history, plus the history of the collective culture that taught you to think and speak. All of that bears weight on the present moment. And you want to have a future direction. You're going to have a goal, even if it's not precisely defined. For example, in the case of freshman essay writers, they knew that no matter what the topic was, that they wanted their essay to be good. That's a really vague goal, but it is future-oriented.
Yeah. If you like this book because of the trippin' groovin' stuff, that's only part of it, and he's explicitly against that. Right? It's the classical too.
Yeah, you cannot get by on dynamic quality alone, as he calls it. You got to have that stabilizing factor, the static quality, he calls it. He brings it up in Zen and the Art and then fully develops it in Lila. This contrast between dynamic and static is exactly what Dylan is talking about. Past and the future, you know, our memories and our plans, that's static and conceptual and abstract. The present moment is dynamic, and you can't have one without the other. You want to preserve the dynamic gains of the past and let them lead you into the future.
That sounds like a great closing sentiment. Next time, we're going to talk about semiotics and structuralism. So we're going to do a few different readings. We're going to read part one of Ferdinand de Saussure's Course in General Linguistics, which set up the idea of structuralism in analyzing language. And then we're going to read a short essay by Claude Lévi-Strauss, The Structural Study of Myth, which applies this sort of analysis to other cultural products. And then we're going to read Jacques Derrida's Structure, Sign, and Play in the Discourse of the Human Sciences, which shows the limitations of the structuralist approach in Lévi-Strauss and the rest of the folks. I want to quickly thank the people who donated large sums of money to us since last time. Those would be Laura Davis, Marcy Antonio, Jeffrey Edwards, Frederick Zerold, Emma Hibling, Amir Zaki, William Cromarty, Kyle Harvey, Soon He An, and Joanne Ciccone.
Madonna's real last name.
Maybe Ciccone. Madonna actually gave us some money.
Maybe Madonna is a fan of the podcast.
Well, we can only hope. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
I've never been one to look at billboards. I don't chance a glance at one now. 1,000 brake lights flashing blinding me, burning the sweat.
sweat off my brow. I pass the toll booth and the traffic stops. Less danger, more boring pain. Gotta get through, gotta get past, gotta keep on moving, moving. The freeway draws me again. The freeway. I have to silence the radio. I need to concentrate and keep myself sane. My head is simmering and coming to a boil. Slowly cooking, cooking my brain. Me again.